This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Joe and Lisa Stone are small-town attorneys in Virginia. The fine residents of Henry County know Stone & Stone as the firm that looks out for the little guy. But when an investigation into the apparent death of a paranoid crackpot inventor reveals an invention that could be worth millions and a big pharmaceutical company that will stop at nothing to own it, things get a little murky for Stone & Stone. That's the premise of Martin Clark's newest legal thriller, The Jezebel Remedy. Martin Clark is a circuit court judge in Virginia. He'll be at Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh on Thursday at 7, but first joins me on the State of Things. Judge Clark, welcome back to the program.
And thanks for having me. It's good to be back.
You have you love this genre. This is not your first your first mystery that has been inspired by your time on the bench, right?
This is number four. Though there was a bit of a gap between Legal Limit, that was my last book, 2008, and this book. I'm a bit of a slow pen. The day job is a source of inspiration, I suppose, and good material, but it also comes first. So I'm not as quick as some of my brethren and sisters in the business.
Well, there's a rich tradition of lawyers and judges writing these books, and we know that doctors too, people in the medical profession are often inspired. My question is, it would seem to me that almost every day something comes before you or every day that you go to work that could be grist for a story. Are there moments where, let's take this one for instance, where something just jumped out and said, oh my goodness, this has to be a novel?
Two things I would say. The first problem I have in terms of material is often people would not believe it. If you have ever been in circuit court, I just hired a new administrative assistant and she is crackerjack and smart, and each day, she would see things that were just jaw-dropping for her. One of the most interesting things is, in this book, in The Jezebel Remedy, several vignettes that were based on fact, they were true, were cut by my very good editor, Gary Fiskejohn, because he said, no one's going to believe that. And I said, Gary, it's true. It's absolutely true. This happened. Most notably, something that was cut, and I don't know if it's a phenomenon in this part of the world. In Patrick County, from time to time, you will see shoes or boots tied together hanging from a power line. Mm-hmm. I understand in some quarters or some areas it is a gang signal or a drug signal. I don't think that's what it is in Patrick County where I live. And there was a vignette in this book on the cutting room floor now. Letty Van Zant, the eccentric cat-loving character from the book, is standing beneath the power line shooting with a .22 rifle at a pair of very nice work boots trying to rupture the laces and claim the boots. And she then calls the fire department to come with a bucket truck to get her shoe she's laying claim to. That really happened where I live. It got cut.
Well, now, let me talk about what made it and the inspiration for it. Tell
right,
us a little
and,
bit.
And the second thing I would say is this book, the what I like to call the didactic or the moral part of the book, is based on basically a true story that occurred in my courtroom. Several years ago, I was prepping my cases for the next day, pull the file. It's a divorce file. My docket simply says, enter divorce decree, and it was set for half an hour. I pull the file, look through it. I'm not sure what you call them in North Carolina, but it's a property settlement agreement, separation agreement. And I look at it, and it's the most phenomenally one-sided agreement I've ever seen. Completely in favor of the husband. It's about a 12-year marriage. The wife was leaving essentially with her car and her clothes and a small portion of her own pension, probably $750,000 worth of assets, maybe $1 million. She's giving it all up. I assume, of course, that what I will be doing in court the following day is dealing with a motion or an argument to set aside the agreement because it's unfair and it's oppressive. The folks show up, and let me note that during the negotiation of the agreement, both sides were represented by counsel. Both sides had lawyers and good lawyers. The husband shows up with his lawyer, and the wife comes by herself. She's pro se, just simply there by herself. And I begin my pitch, a standard warning, you're going to be at a disadvantage, where's your lawyer? And she stops me and she says, I just want to address my husband. And this is really the only way I can do it and the only venue, not her word, but the only place I can do it. And she basically says to him, we had a decade of a good marriage, and I made a mistake. And it was, by the way, the nuclear mistake. This wasn't I spilled nail polish on the bathroom tile. This was adultery.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it persisted for about 2 months. And she evidently deeply regretted it so much that she was willing to sort of pay in her own mind this economic and marital penalty of giving away everything that they'd worked for during the marriage. And she looked at him and said, is there anything I can do to recover our marriage, to put this back together? From where I sit on the bench, I can see the husband, and I can see him lean into his lawyer, and I can read his lips, and it's no. But that prompted me, and that's the getting off point for the Jezebel remedy. And the question is there a cure? Is there a fix? Is there something you can do if you are a genuinely remorseful spouse and you feel bad? Is there something you can do to cure your marriage, to fix that mistake? And if there is, exactly what is it? Is it practical, religious? What can you do? In this case, it was never fixed, but I had never seen anything like that. And that, as I say, prompted me to start writing about Lisa and Joe Stone.
They are the attorneys in this case. And we should say that in a sense, they become a subplot throughout because the ultimate mystery revolves your cat-loving inventor and slightly paranoid inventor. And that's the theme of this. So this is the jumping off point, which is the relationship between these two lawyers who are going to come to represent our protagonist in some ways.
My friend Robert Earl Keen, every novel I write begins with a quote from Robert Earl Keen, and this novel begins with his line, I'm guilty of a dreadful, selfish crime. I have wasted all my precious time. And that is where we pick up with Lisa Stone and her husband, and she is at this point in her life, she is worried that, am I where I need to be? Am I wringing everything I can out of life vocationally? In terms of my marriage, in terms of where I want to be. And it's that restlessness and that sort of introspection that, again, sets the stage for what I like to call the fun part. And I always hate to talk about my books because when you sit here and you talk about marital misconduct in court, it seems sort of grim and drab and unhappy, and my books aren't. At least I hope they aren't.
Well, no, they are entertaining, but you need some drama, right? There has to be some relief and tension. And, of course, that's one of the main tensions, the Stone's marriage and how that – well, Jezebel remedy, until your book came out, this is a term that was unfamiliar to me.
Jezebel?
Well, Jezebel I knew.
Oh. Well, Jezebel remedy is the title. I just made that up.
Okay. I thought
that was
just
mine.
A legal term. I thought so you lawyers say, oh, no, we're not going to go to the Jezebel remedy here.
No,
and then
that's...
you guys, and then you'd put on your cloak and you'd go out and – You put on your gown and
no, I promise you,
grab your gavel.
That's not something we're whispering about,
oh.
And that's not something behind the scenes. That's just mine. That's just again, and the other part though, the title does have a double meaning because crazy Letty Van Zandt has created something that may in fact be a remedy, and Big Pharma is after it, and it has value, or maybe it doesn't have value, and that's sort of the fun, the adventure, the legal part of the story, as the Stones try to find out what Letty has invented, is it worthwhile, and why are people disappearing or being killed.
Will you read for us?
I will. What this is, as I indicated, Lisa Stone is debating where she is in her life, and she is a little bit unhappy with her vocational status. She is a small-town general practitioner. This is a little bit of...
A practitioner of law, just a reminder.
Yeah, she's a lawyer.
Yeah.
And this is just a little bit of what I think is called interior monologue when she is thinking to herself. And let me add this preface before I read this. This is the kind of law I practiced, and I did a lot of plaintiff's work. And so for all my my friends and fellow lawyers who do plaintiff's work, understand this is fiction. Now, maybe there's a grain of truth in there, but I can write this because it's what I did myself.
Yeah, all right.
There was money to be made suing for car wreck checks, large money, in fact. And there were any number of deserving folks who found themselves being scammed and cheated by slippery insurance companies and their unscrupulous adjusters. But after years and years of it, she'd had a belly full. Enough. And say what you might, no matter how much skill you brought to the courtroom and how ethical you were and how hefty the verdicts and how magnificently you could bewitch a jury, there was still something seamy about personal injury work. And though few in the legal trade actually gave voice to it, the blowhards on TV and the screaming billboards with mammoth headshots and audacious dollar signs pretty much spoke volumes, same as the local automobile hustlers or the state lottery. More Barnum than Barrister, more Charles Ponzi than Antonin Scalia. She occasionally inquired of Joe if this was why the heck they'd gone to law school, why they'd memorize federal civil procedure and studied the Constitution just so they could earn a buck off whiplashes, pain meds, soft collars, and trips to physical therapy.
So she decides. I mean, this is a case that really does have a lot of significance. This is really the little guy against big pharma. It seems it's stacking up that way. And there are a lot of themes, it seems to me, that work their way through this book, including the importance of forensic evidence. It becomes an important part in your book. But I know you've had a chance to talk about that in the legal system and kind of how that plays out and how things have changed for juries and for judges these days in the post-CSI world that we're living in.
Absolutely. And that is, I suppose, one of the and it seems like I have a whole plate of themes, a whole smorgasbord, but it's interesting to me, and it's translated in the book. It's a fascinating question, and I think that people see it through the prism now of CSI or forensic evidence. But is it possible for a system that was created by men, and I underscore the word men, mm-hmm. who believed in medicinal leeches and set store by Poor Richard's Almanac, to accommodate what we do now in a judicial system, and most notably accommodate, deal with, and effectively process forensic evidence? And it has revolutionized what we do. When I began practicing law, basically you had some core things, some fingerprints, blood typing, but nothing like you have now. Nothing. Jurors understood in many cases, especially sexual assault cases, that their job would be to come in, to listen carefully, to analyze the testimony, to hold it up against a background of common sense. Now, jurors, to a man and woman, expect, in many cases, some sort of forensic data. Mm-hmm. And they will tell you in voir dire, in the questioning process, that if it is not there, they will not convict. And they will literally say to you, how would I ever know? Mm-hmm. It's just going to be a swearing contest. It has completely changed the mindset of jurors and the public. And it's good that we have it. But one of the things the book deals with is it's not as certain as you would like to think. It still has a subjective element in it, and it's pretty easily manipulated if you think about it on the front end of things. And that's what happens to Joe and Lisa Stone. They find themselves, as lawyers who've been in the system, on the receiving end of some fairly gross, as one of the characters says, trickeration, to use a Bernie Mac word. And they debate, well, gee, do we play this straight? Do we use the system? We know where the weak points are, the trap doors. Do we play this straight? Or do we engage in some skullduggery of our own?
Well, and I think, referred to a legal system that was designed by men who believed in medicinal leeches. And I think the reference there would be, folks who didn't have the sort of sense of science that we have today. But maybe the converse is true. Maybe they put too much weight on reason, the capacity of individuals to only use reason in a court of law, when in fact we know there's a heck of a lot more that comes to a decision than just a simple weighing of the facts.
And the split in the book, of course, the dichotomy is that Lisa is ready to jump ship. She is ready to get in the ditch and take the gloves off and fight corruption with corruption. But Joe, true to his nature, says, I have invested in this system my whole life. I have told every client that I've ever had that it works and it produces. It may be a Byzantine trip, but it's going to give you the right outcome in the long run. And I'm not jumping ship. I'm going to stick with the system. Now, I won't give away how it all plays out, because that would give away the ending of the book. But But that is the tension. You're exactly right. And it's a fun tension. I mean, obviously, people find fault with the legal system, and there's plenty of fault to find. But I guess the point is, at least for me, forensic evidence and the advancements are not quite the cure-all or the benefit that you might suspect. And let me highlight what I mean by that. The last, I'm not sure the number, but let's say the last 10 to 11 jury trials I've had involving a sexual assault or a rape, they've all been not guilty save one, not guilty. And we could almost, you almost can't see the jury because the jurors will say, well, there's no forensic evidence. It's just going to be a swearing contest. I don't know.
And you've said that differs, for instance, in another kind of assault case. In other cases, a forensic evidence doesn't play as much of a role in the mind of jurors in your observation.
Yeah, it's just a sort of a cultural conditioning they've had, a media conditioning, a television, a CSI conditioning. Our Commonwealth's attorney, who's very Stephanie Vipperman, is a very bright, gifted Commonwealth's attorney, and she'll say, "Now wait a minute, listen. If I walked outside and someone hit me in the head and took my purse, that would be robbery, and the only evidence you're going to have is I'm going to say Frank hit me in the head and took my purse, and you wouldn't be demanding evidence for that. Why can't you evaluate testimony in this context, in this case, the same as you would in that case?" And it's amazing to me the transformation we've seen in the judicial system.
Judge Clark, it's good to talk with you about this novel and the way some of these themes work their way through it. Judge Martin Clark, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, as always.
Martin Clark is a circuit court judge in Virginia. His newest novel is called The Jezebel Remedy, and he will be at Quail Ridge Books Thursday at 7 o'clock. You can find out more about the book at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Hadi Mawagdi, and Will Michaels. Robin Copley is our technical director. Andrew Tai is our intern. Brent Wolf is WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.